This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. But the korimako, or bellbird, has a much more interesting diet of nectar. It's been something of a radio personality and has sung on shortwave radio to Australia and the Pacific nations for 30 years. However, the early recordings failed to reflect the versatility of the bellbird, with its wide variety of liquid notes and artistically placed clicks and bell-like sounds. It's not surprising that Maori mythology describes korimako, the bellbird, as the messenger of Tane, sent to herald the coming of the sun.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.nz.
Good morning, friends. Welcome to Community or Chaos. I've had a second of chaos. Well, I'm pushing the wrong button, but I don't know if that was noticed, so I probably shouldn't mention it. We have Murray Grimwood with us today, a hands-on environmentalist who saw the limits to growth coming a long time ago, and he was advocating getting ready for sustainability from 1986 or before. Welcome to Community or Chaos.
Hi, Marvin.
Well, you can listen to this by going to oar.org.nz and then going to community and then going to podcast. Actually, you've got that backwards. You go to oar.org.nz, then going to OAR Radio, and then go to podcast, then going to Community or Chaos. And I need another cup of coffee. Well, Murray, what do you think about the Iranian war and the energy crisis? And is the crisis temporary?
Yeah, let's start with a little subject, say. Let's start with the small ones. What it's showing up probably is that a lot of people have approached thinking about things in terms of money, and what we're actually seeing is hard supply issues. The real-time stuff that money used to buy and you used to assume that it bought. And so we're seeing conventional media interviewing people like Nicola Willis, our finance minister, as to really whether there's going to be any oil in 3 weeks' time. It's the wrong person, and we've got away with it while the planet had enough stuff for us all and there was, you know, only 4 or 5 or 6 billion of us. But there's 8 billion of us now. There's too many for the planet to support, and we're half emptied the planet. So you can see the Iran war is just one in a series of scraps over who gets what left, what's left. And I don't think we're reading it that way very well.
Isn't it? Nicola Willis right when she's confident that oil prices will drop soon and save the economic recovery?
It's not prices and it's not the economy we've got to worry about. It's actually having energy to do things, to do work and to do stuff. The price is absolutely irrelevant. The sun will come up tomorrow, regardless of price of anything, and even if we are still trading in stuff called money. The question is whether you've got energy and resources to do something with.
Well, when's that? What's likely to happen? Is this a? I know it's part of a long-term crisis in a sense, because of not only peak oil but also the environmental crisis that we're all facing.
Well, it's a depletion versus an overpopulation problem. We were probably overpopulated at 4 billion in 1980, according to William Catton, who wrote the book, and so we're well overshot now at 8 billion and climbing. And so we're arguing about who gets access to or owns what's left, particularly the energy resources. And That's what the two Iraq wars were about. That was, in a way, what Afghanistan was about. That's what the blowing up of the pipeline a couple of years back was about. This is energy wars.
Now, when we talk about population, you're right, we've got probably too many people for the earth. But isn't the population going down?
Enough to be not a problem. That it's absolutely true that everybody on the planet now won't be here in 100 years' time. That's absolutely true of all of us. But the problem is the attrition rate from the 8 billion chewing up the planet. We're already very, very late. And species don't actually voluntarily reduce populations very easily of anything.
Well, in countries like Italy and Spain, there are Catholic countries where birth control hasn't been part of their culture until recently.
Well, that was because the Catholic Church made the same mistake that economists make, where they think more people make you richer, and so they wanted more Catholics.
But
the actually
point
makes
is
you
that,
poorer as the sprawling
the point
suburbs.
Is that Spain and Italy are both, their population's dropping quite fast.
Yes, that's fine. That's really good. Anywhere that the population's dropping fast is going to have a much easier path of it in the future.
Even in China, the population's dropping.
Yep. But you'll notice the economists in this country say that's a problem. It's a danger and it's a problem. And we get into a side issue where economists still think of people doing work, in quotation marks, as labour. But in actual fact, it's fossil energy that does the work. We're mere noise compared to that.
Well, I guess in some ways I have had a quarrel with economists for a long time because they also think that unemployment is good for the economy and good for society.
Well, actually, in terms of resource depletion, it possibly is because unemployed people don't tend to spend as much on bits of the planet as rich people. So in a way, we've actually got to do less. I think you might need to reframe what you call unemployed.
Okay, well, yeah. Part of the fact is we haven't – what we do now is we actually – talk about the unemployed as though it was their fault.
Oh, I see. Side issue to
the
me.
Homeless.
Side issue. Compared to where the planet's going, and I don't regard that as an issue.
Can governments govern if there's a large minority of the people who don't trust the government and feel like they've been let down?
No, your validity disappears. So exactly what Trump is. Trump, if you got rid of Trump now, you wouldn't change the problem that the US has, which is people have no faith in the system, the political system, being any good for them.
So, too, you have to really somehow convince people that you're governing for the common good if you're going to get them to support you.
Well, you actually have to – you almost can't, because if the common good is actually having more stuff per person
– Well, it doesn't have to be that, does it?
No, it doesn't, but that's what we've been conditioned to do, and that's what most people think of, and most people vote for their back pockets.
Well, I'm not sure that's what most people think of when they think of the common good. That's what most people think of when they vote yes.
Yeah, most people don't think of the common good, I'm sorry. Most people think of their own back pocket good.
But maybe this is why we should have – leadership that encourages people to think about the common good, including the common good of the planet.
You've actually got to go back two steps. If you have a media and an academia who are both preaching that wealth is the way to go, and academia do it even though they know better knowledge-wise because they need bums on seats to keep their universities going. So between academia and the media, the public are told – that all is good and it's onward and upward and you can be richer tomorrow, and you know. And so that's what we get in the way of politicians.
Well, you don't necessarily have to be an academic to know that.
No.
Neither of us are academics.
But those are the two founts of knowledge that people rely on, except what we're getting now, of course, is social media, which is diffusing it a bit.
What you see the energy crisis as a symptom of war?
Yeah, yeah. The energy crisis is a crisis of our eruption as a species, our overshoot. So what we did was we tapped into, first of all, we tapped into firewood, which was a store of solar energy. So it may have actually been a mistake in ecological hindsight, but we've been there for a while. And having raised the firewood around us, we had civilizations rise and fall. The Romans fell through lack of firewood. But historians don't tell you that because they're not physicists. But really, it's an energy input to the system every time. And finally, 200 years ago, we cracked into coal and then we cracked into oil and gas. And at every step of the way, we haven't displaced what was behind. We're burning more firewood on the planet now than we did in 1800. But we've added oil, coal and gas to the firewood.
That's one of the things I wanted to talk about, and I'll be talking about that again, is that countries that have increased their non-carbon energy have still increased their use of carbon energy.
Well, yeah, because half the non-carbon energy, if you trace your solar panels and your electric cars and all the rest of it, you find that it's fossil energy building it.
What about once it's built?
Once it's built, it gets better. It's still serviced. You think of our grid and all the utes that drive out there with guys in their utes to fix the grid and maintain the dams and all that. It's and the windmills, you know. That's all fossil energy backed. The question upside down is, can you run a, quote, renewable energy system, unquote, without fossil energy input? And the answer is probably not.
But if you were willing to have a no-growth economy.
Even so, you would have to actually have gone back many pegs, and we're probably talking peasant-level living, right, in terms of consumption and throughput. I'm sorry, but that's where it would be without fossil energy. That was a huge hit that we tapped into, and it's a one-off.
You don't think that we could replace it partially with solar energy and wind farms and other?
No, not a hope. There's a guy who did Renewable Energy Without the Hot Air was the book and the free site. The book is a free download too. David Mackay, late David Mackay, he was physics professor at Oxford or Cambridge. I can't remember which one of the two. The amount of area you would have to cover at the efficiency rates that we can garnish it, which is 25% efficiency. So every square metre that you cover, you get a quarter of a square metre return of solar energy. You'd have to cover like the whole of Britain to power Britain. You can't do it.
Is it. What about wind farms and wave energy?
Wind is probably worse than PV. Solar at least doesn't break down and run out of gearboxes and have issues maintaining it. It just sort of decays gracefully over a, 30-year period. But the amount of energy you require to do things like smelting and laying roads, and nobody's talked about what you make roads out of.
Asphalt, oil.
Well, oil, exactly so.
But you don't have to. You can have a decent society with people not having individual cars. I mean, when I first came to New Zealand in Whanganui, many families didn't have cars, and very few families had three or four.
You're still a society running on fossil energy. You take it away, and you'd be surprised what we don't have. Even back then, people had trucks delivering groceries, and there was the veggie man with his truck and all the rest of it. You take all of that away and try and run that on electrics, which is all that renewables do, and you'll be struggling. Nobody has built PV panels or windmills or dams using renewable energy? Nobody. Sorry, did.
Yeah, but if
and
you I'm, didn't
I'm
use.
No, I'm no you, knocker either. I've lived off grid for more than 20 years now.
If
so.
You use. If you didn't use any renewable energy for private use or for anything but creating solar panels or wind, if you didn't use oil or coal for anything but building renewable energy,
it would last longer.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, we'd have to give up the idea of having cars. You'd probably have to give up the idea of flying.
Yep. I've long said that EVs are the – I like the technology, but EVs are the right answer to the wrong question. Yeah. And back to fossil energy and population and consumption, one of the big ones, of course, is that about half our food is nitrogen fertilizer from natural gas, as we're finding out now that some of it isn't going to come out of the Straits of Hormuz. If you take the Haber-Bosch nitrogen fertilizer process out of circulation, the natural gas supplied system, if you take that out, half the human population isn't here. Just like that.
Well, I'm not sure you're right about that.
Okay.
I'm looking at China. I'm looking at China, not now. I'm looking at China 100 years ago.
Yeah, China has very deep, loose soils that some of us don't have. Yeah. And also China had a population somewhat less than it does now.
Oh, it still had a big population.
Yeah.
And they had environmental problems. They had floods.
Well, they're desertifying in the northern Indian, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, they've had environmental problems for centuries.
Okay, yeah. Anyway, ex-Haber-Bosch, ex-fertilizers out of natural gas, we are in trouble feeding ourselves long-term without soil depletion. That's another issue, really. Yeah.
What do you suggest we do then?
Voluntarily, we ought to be reducing population flat out, and I'm talking New Zealand as well. We should be aiming for like 2 million or maybe one in over a period of decades, which everybody throws up their hands and looks in horror, but it's a lot easier feeding 1 million ex-fossil energy than it is feeding 5 or 6.
Our population, what's it doing now? I mean, people born in New Zealand.
Oh, it depends on immigration. You can easily make it reduce quietly. But there's another misconception that we ought to cover there too when we're talking food in New Zealand and population. The Federated Farmers propaganda touted so often that people take it as gospel is that we feed 40 million people. New Zealand feeds 40 million people is the cry. It's absolute bollocks. There might be 40 million mouths who get a taste of our milk powder and some processed food further down the food chain, but we don't feed 40 million people, and all we produce is milk powder. Actually feeding ourselves off our ground would be a different, completely different animal.
Well, we used to, before we focused entirely on milk powder, we used to grow much of our own wheat, for instance.
Oh, we had market gardens for Africa. Remember Outram and Kakanui and all those places? They were just market gardens for all gone, economically squashed out. But if supplies stop coming, and you imagine stopping the shipping coming to New Zealand, which is the sort of spectre we're looking at. How long could we last, and how fast could we plant enough to feed ourselves? I don't think it's all that easy.
Should we be planning on that? I mean, should we actually be zoning stop?
Well,
should
we
zone
from my
good horticultural land so it can be built on?
It's too late. I stood up in Silver Peaks County Council 40 years ago now and said we shouldn't have one more house on the Tairi. Look at it. Still going, and there's still people in the city council who think it's a great idea. You know, it's just nuts. That said, you can do an awful lot of growing in an awful lot of places, and you can put glasshouses just about anywhere. But your problem then is things like sterile seeds that they sell, so you have to buy them next year. So we have to have a system where you harvest seeds that aren't sterile, all that. And you have to do it perhaps within less than a growing season. Yeah, I wouldn't be in a government now for love nor money.
Okay, what should we do that's positive?
What should we do that's positive? More food that's grown locally, and I mean locally right down to the backyard, or in groups, or in allotments, or in combined. I just heard some people the other day who've asked a local farmer 18 years ago for a small, that must have been an acre or something, off the side of his farm, which was of no account to him. They grow, they meet there once a week, they grow their stuff. He gets a share, equal share of what's grown, the farmer. And they're 18 years down the track and only two of the original people as they've cycled through. That sounds like a good arrangement. And yeah, as much local food, because local food doesn't need transported, right? It's already where it has to be. And it's probably going to be better for you. I was just listening to a thing this morning on national radio that healthy age, healthy peak age of people in the UK is dropping across all income segments, mostly through obesity and lack of effort, lack of fitness. So doing your own food is, A, gets you out there doing something. B, it's better for you than the garbage. Yeah, local food production at all levels.
Do you think public transport is a better option than everybody a car?
Yeah, but I don't think it's. I was thinking in terms of public transport and electrifying things and rail, maybe 20 years ago. Now I ask the question: why are you travelling? And why are you in a hurry? Because a lot of that's to do with the work system we have, which is to do with the consumption system we have. And if all that slows down or gets less, then you're going to have more time if you want to go anywhere. You're not going to need to go anywhere as often. You'll plan your trips better. Yeah, all that.
So you might still need transport, but you wouldn't need as much.
Absolutely. Most of our trips are actually discretionary. And if all of us had to pare back, I'm sure most of us could. There are people on gig wages who may be at work at times and in places where there's no public transport and are stuck in vehicles. And I'm not sure how you unwind all that tangle of stuff. But by and large, most people, it's largely discretionary. It's just a choice of ease, really.
And
we've got a long way from Moran.
Are we going to get resupplied this time?
I can't read that. But even if we do, the world is probably not going to go back to the flow. Before the Iran war, we were knocking on or just above 100 million barrels of oil that we go through a day. Those are 44-gallon drums, right?
Yeah.
And we're talking 100 million of them a day. First of all, that rate can't be kept up for too long. Secondly, you can know how far we are through it because we're down to fracking, we're down to tar sands, and we're down to deep water offshore. If there were better options onshore, if there were still gushers like the Beverly Hillbilly stuff, we'd be doing that first. So you know they're gone. There's the tail end of what was easy stuff, like the Middle East oil fields, but they are well past prime. And so this is coming, this depletion is coming. And so I'm not sure that by the time they've got all that infrastructure rebuilt, and I think there's more damage than we're being told, by the time they've got it rebuilt, if they get it rebuilt, I don't think we'll ever be back to the volumes that we saw a year ago.
Could that be a good thing?
For the planet, yes. For other species, absolutely. A less bad thing rather than a good thing. We're bad at saying things like this is good for the planet, when actually what this is less bad for the planet. And so, yeah, less bad is the actual word, the actual description. Yeah. But also the problem, and it may become quite exacerbated, is that if you start pulling energy out of the system, like 10% not coming, then goodbye economic growth, goodbye all the bets on economic growth, which means repayments of interest, hello inflation, which means reduction in the value of what your money will buy, which is obvious. And so then you're going to have two things. You're going to have countries fighting over what's left, and you're also going to have people finding that their what they thought was savings and wealth and all the rest of it, investments, all of a sudden isn't there or isn't going as far. So things get dire compoundly, you know. And whether we end up in a series of wars over what's left, or whether our global financial system crashes, or whether it splits into two or three blocks, I think that's a possibility. Don't know. Can't tell.
Do you think New Zealand should have an independent foreign policy while we still have?
Yes. I think we're too toady to the US. The US at the moment is a failing hegemony.
Well, that's pretty clear.
And if you eliminate Trump and his cohort, you still don't solve the problem that voted him in. So yeah. I think the US is on the way out. It's already, when you look at it, it's retreating and it can't be the global policeman anymore. It hasn't got the grunt. So what and who takes over in what way, I don't know. China's the obvious successor, but China plays a different game. And I'm not sure I don't know what will happen. It's very likely that another block of countries, and I'm guessing it looks like China, India, Malaysia, Iran, Russia, a few South American countries, Cuba, those places, might end up being a block. They seem to have an affinity of being not in the US block. Europe is a question mark because it also is on the way. Energy lacking. Japan, don't know. And yeah, so I can see realignments of blocks, and all sorts of there's reasons to join people and reasons not to join people. You know, yeah.
Australia is really quite, their military and other structures wedded to the United States now. They're actually increasing their
Yeah, they have been a forward base for Australia for a long time, and they are socially different to us. I've got a partner who's born in Australia, and yeah.
How are they socially different?
I think the original pedigree stock, and the white brigade will hate me for this, but the original stock that went to Australia were people who were at the bottom end of the feeding chain in England and got sent there as cannon fodder / labour. And those who came to New Zealand, a lot of it was like here, it was the being kicked off their land. And they had enough bottle to come out here, leave family and friends behind, and go for something new. So there was toing and froing between, and that's not a black and white thing. But Australia has never been the same culture as New Zealand. There's more graft there.
But culturally and physically, we're closer to Australia than any other country.
Australia hitched itself to the US bought into the domino theory back in the Vietnam days, got worried about the yellow peril to the north of it, and has had Pine Gap and Woomera forever. So Australia is different to us, but we have this last few years toadied to the Americans more than we needed to. We shouldn't be part of Five Eyes. We should be.
Canada's pulled out of Five Eyes.
Yeah. Well, it's time we did. Mark Carney, there's a lot of things you can say about Mark Carney. He was head of the Bank of England at one point. And he's certainly part of the elite. But he reads this and read it. His speech at Davos was magisterial. And so he's well aware that the system we've had is disintegrating and not coming back. And where Canada goes, it's worth watching, because that's where we probably should be going.
Well, that's frankly my feeling about it.
Of a likeness, Canadians are probably as close to us as anyone. Yeah. India, I don't rate in that regard. I think India has been done over by the West long enough that it's probably got a resentment per se. Yeah.
My worry about Australia is that it's going to be hard to say no to Australia.
I'm not sure. Australia's got problems of its own and may have trouble controlling them. Don't know. And Australia's rearmament program is far too late for whatever's happening. Whatever's happening is going to be over in the next 10 years.
Well, those submarines are crazy. I mean, it's not what they need, even if you think in military terms, the AUKUS.
The US treat Australia as a forward base. But remember that the US has something like 700, is it, bases around the planet in other people's countries, which are essentially parts of America. And if some of their personnel misbehave compared to the locals, they're never charged. They're whisked out of the country before they can be charged. So I don't know how many ladies in countries around the world are gnashing their teeth at some absentee. But that's how the Americans have been for the last 70 years. Australia is just another forward base. And the one different thing about Australia is it's probably the major mine for the planet. It's probably the biggest mine.
But the way I see it, I think that New Zealand should have an independent foreign policy.
Yep.
I'm not sure that we spend too much energy and wealth on conventional military growth.
Well, what we've got to read from the last couple of wars, which are still ongoing, both Ukraine and Iran were meant to be over in a few hours or weeks or days. Both of them are still trundling on, and I don't know how long Iran goes, but Ukraine's into years. It looks like asymmetric warfare is now unachievable by a major, Russia and US. Neither have been able to be dominant. And it appears that asymmetric warfare is now takes more effort to counter. So what that tells us is that things are changing, and maybe it's not worth fighting over resources anymore. That you actually expend more energy on it and resources than you get back, which makes the world an interesting place.
How do you see our relationship with China?
China? I don't know. The politicians at the top are ruthless, and they don't have democracy to guide them. Can you say anything different about the US at the moment? No.
Well, China's got an older cultural history than America.
Yeah, it has.
They're certainly been influenced by Maoism and Marx and by pragmatism, but they're also maybe interested by Confucianism.
Yeah, that's still an autocracy, and yeah, it's still dangerous, and it still shoots people. But the way Trump's going, that's going to be no different in the States. And those of us who still practice democracy, I see a democracy as diminished of what it was 40, 50 years ago. But we're still practicing it. And I do hope that we hang on to that, because I think that kind of interrelationship is important internally and externally.
I think that New Zealand's more likely to hang on to democracy than many countries.
Actually, I'll go back to the China and answer the question, the part of the question I didn't. What China took from us was we decided that their wages were less and we could offshore all our manufacturing capability, all our making capability.
Well, that was
and
stupid.
Pay them peanuts. Yes, it was stupid. And the wave of people in New Zealand who have the skills to do that are all heading for rest homes now. We've lost the continuity. So making stuff for ourselves would be a skill that we could never have enough of, starting now, and bringing all the manufacturing we can back. And if it costs more, well, that's the price of what it costs. Because relying on China for manufacturing and also...
Well, it makes it more difficult for you to...
Yeah, and also there's a tendency, because you can't afford the best, to pick up the garbage, which, you know, I can tell you what doesn't work. It's in you see it turning up at the transfer station every time. There are things we shouldn't be buying because they're just a waste of planetary resources, because they're junk. And so making good quality stuff that lasts, that can be repaired, and making it locally and repairing it locally, can't get enough of it.
How do you see the future of Europe? Because they're looking to change, but they're not.
I would not be surprised to find Europe disintegrating back to its component parts. If growth and hegemony are factors of energy input into a system, and I'd argue they are, then you've seen a high water mark globally, and you're going to see it ebb. And I think Britain pulling away was the beginning of the end of the EU. It won't solve their problems, but nonetheless, I'd think its days are probably gone long term. There'll be partnerships within it, and cooperation, and a reluctance to go to war, but nonetheless, I see it having high water marked.
I mean, they did just make the decision they weren't going to be going to war in the Middle East for the sake of the United States.
There have been some very brave comments and political statements made from Spain, from Italy in the end.
That's surprising from Italy.
Surprising from Italy and from Turkey, who we get bad-mouthed in the West. They are astute and they are quite clear. And along with Carney, we're starting to see people realising that the world has shifted and that the US has to be abandoned. There are implications for that too. For Israel, which has become essentially a genocidal, you know.
I think Israel's decisions in the last, they've been going, I mean, in 67 they could have had two states.
Yeah.
For a time anyway.
Yeah.
But their use of ethnic cleansing, moving into genocide, I think they're, they've always been dependent to some extent on overseas support.
Yes, but they've had enough of their own infiltrating the US since Kissinger and Wolfowitz and the long train of them to make sure they have the US support, the military support.
But that will not continue.
Well, I'm wondering whether that lasts and whether Israel can last.
It won't last for two reasons. The first thing is that the next generation of Americans don't want to do it.
Right.
And the other thing is that America is going to get weaker in some ways.
Yes. Yes, I agree. And Israel might find that there are some annoyed people surrounding it.
Well.
And it's got nobody else to blame but itself.
You'd be annoyed too if you were.
Yeah.
I mean,
and what amazes me is, having been the victims of a genocide, they've turned around and perpetrated.
I find this very difficult.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They didn't learn. They absolutely didn't learn. And it comes back to another.
And Judaism, I think, outside of Israel, particularly in America, no longer can Israel depend on their absolute support no matter what they do.
No. One of the interesting things is how we...
But Judaism is... What they're doing is actually going against the Jewish religious culture.
Oh, you can pick bits out of the Old Testament if you need
to. Oh, I'm not talking about the Old Testament. I'm talking about Judaism for the last 2,000 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Rabbinical Judaism is quite a different...
Mm. One of the things that worries me is that this seems to be a trait in humans anyway, that we, and it might be something to do with this Dunbar's number of people you can recognize with familiarity, which is I think Dunbar called it 150 people that you can relate to properly, and after that it's just two-dimensional. But we seem to be able to otherize others and treat them as if they're not human. I saw an amazing doco of an Arab lady reporter who would turn up at the barricades in Gaza dressed in Arab garb, and the Israeli soldiers would hear her talking but would look right through her. To them, she did not exist as a person. If she turned up in Western garb, they addressed her as a human, same person. So we have this huge ability to demote others as non-human, therefore they're expendable the way animals are.
If you're going to treat people horribly, one of the first things you do is change them into the other.
That's right, yeah. So that does worry me about our species a little bit. And it makes me think that maybe our ultimate eventual change will be to local enough that we're just 150 groups of 150. Which doesn't bode well for big cities.
If you were Prime Minister, what would you be doing?
Running away.
I know.
What a job. If I was the Prime Minister of New Zealand now,
yeah.
I'd be making noises like Mark Carney, but a wee bit clearer. I would be telling people that we'd probably reached. Actually, the French President Macron, about 3 years ago, did this. He actually said, "We're at the end of the age of abundance." And nobody in the Western media picked it up because they didn't know what he was talking about.
I didn't even know he said it.
Yeah, 2022. Macron, the age of abundance is over. Right, he got it, absolutely got it, and he can't be the only one. They must know, you know. That's why the elite want to get off the planet and head to Mars.
Oh, that just shows they're insane.
Well,
I mean, you think the Earth is a
if you can't look after the Earth enough to live on it, then you got no hope looking after Mars. It's not gonna happen.
Apparently, from what I've read, that even the soil on Mars is poisonous.
Oh.
This shows the what happens to people when they have too much entitlement and too much wealth and not enough reality. If they believe that they can go to Mars and start again, they believe that they can live forever by putting their brain into a computer. Well, what does that tell you about their culture?
Yeah, it tells you that they're worried about dying. And insecure, really, about their lives, but which is interesting.
But it also tells you that they're pretty insane.
Well, in a way, yes. And the movie Don't Look Up, that last scene of it where they've spent 22,000 years cryogenically being flown by this spaceship and they only had an attrition rate of 45%, and you go, wow, you know, and then you think, we haven't made electronics to last 100 years. Let alone 22,000 unattended and maintained. It doesn't happen. You know? What was the onboard energy source? Doesn't happen. You know? So their stuff is pipe dreams.
And well, you probably have to look at science fiction as fairy stories.
Yeah.
In some way, at least the ones that aren't dystopic. Yeah.
But just remember that the elite are dependent on the system, the financial system, still staying intact. And if it doesn't, they're worth the same as you and I are. So I count them as an interesting side effect, but not a major force.
Well, so you think the idea that they can put up bunkers in Paraguay and so on, they'll be all right? Is
I think your bunker, the moment you run out of share markets and things like that, what's the person worth, and will they keep paying a militia, and will the militia stay loyal? And the answer is maybe. But I wouldn't be putting money on it.
How long do you think – is the world economy going to recover from this particular –
My betting is no. It may, and I may be wrong. But my betting is the odds are no. I reckon we've hit the ceiling here. And the longer it goes on, I don't think we recover. Whether we fudge it and pretend that GDP got better because we had lots of wars and they were good for GDP, I'm not sure. But in terms of resources and people and well-being, nah, we're at the peak now. Yeah.
Mm. If you were Prime Minister, how would you talk to people?
I would say that we have to look at being resilient, capable of withstanding a scenario where nothing comes. Where essentially it's like the cargo cultists who saw American munitions arriving in the Pacific Islands over World War II and thought all you had to have was a runway and a control tower and a guy with two table tennis bats at the end of the runway, and all of a sudden you'd get stuff. And they built these runways and they built these mock towers and they stood at the end with paddle bats, but no, stuff came. So you have to sort of explain to people that we have a situation where it may well be stuff stops coming, and that we have to have contingency plans to keep what we can keep running, health, presumably education, presumably the grid, but that's a question mark, but probably the grid, and sanitation and things like that, and food.
I think one thing is going to go very quickly. Is the internet.
I think we're going to see that now. Iran's just shut it down for how many days? And I think nations will start chopping themselves off from the major internet. And I think we're going to find all of a sudden that we should have kept our books, because a lot of the information we thought we had at our fingertips might not just be there the way we thought it was.
Yeah, if you want to write something and keep it, don't just put it in your computer.
Yeah, I'm in circles that keep books, and I know one librarian who actually bought herself a shipping container and fills it.
Wow.
Yeah, useful things that might be useful in a resilient future. Mm.
Yeah. Well, I've got a built-in bookcase.
Yeah, but we're in the minority. Most people nowadays run screens rather than books.
I do use my screen for this job I'm doing right now.
Yep.
But I know that it's temporary.
Yeah, indeed. I wouldn't rely on it, for knowledge. Yeah.
I mean, I think you could, in theory, you could keep emails going, like you use the old phone system.
Yeah, the problem is the old phone system, a lot of the stuff's all gone. And one of the problems is, and there's a guy called Ronald Wright who wrote a book called Short History of Progress. And he said that one of the problems is that as we climb the ladder, we kick the rungs out behind us. We dismantle all the previous technologies. You can't go back to dial-up telephones. They aren't there anymore.
I still have one.
Yeah, but they aren't there anymore. You know, the exchanges aren't there. You can't go back. There's no switchboard potential anymore. It's just you wouldn't rebuild it, and it's not there.
Why couldn't you rebuild it? Because of the copper?
You'd have to put copper landlines in for everywhere and train people up to run switchboards, PABXs. It's not going to happen. and the gear isn't there. And by the time we get to that stress, we're going to be too busy doing food and maintaining what we've got. Yeah. Some of those rungs won't get created, recreated. And that will make an interesting story because communication will be an interesting thing. Mm.
I don't see the bar. What I don't see is the social media and the they shouldn't be building that thing in Southland for database.
Data centers and so on are a waste of time, and they'll be shut down immediately the moment you have trouble because they're superfluous. They're not any use.
They use huge amounts of energy. They're bad for the environment.
Yes, they do. And what they serve you is not food. We will all be too busy working our way through the food chain to stay alive. And, I see two-thirds of city folk disappearing into the countryside in the food system, and ultimately. It's just a reversal of what happened when fossil fuels allowed them to come off the land and go into cities. We've covered a lot.
Yeah. Do you think the Green Party gets it? The Labour Party certainly doesn't.
No. I think Chloe Swarbrick probably is the highest IQ person in the Parliament. Certainly to me she appears that way. Could she get it? Yes. Does she get it? I'm not sure. Does anybody else get it? I reckon they must. There must be a smattering of people through Parliament, probably more left than right, who actually get it, but who can't acknowledge that because it would be political suicide. And it raises a bigger question. Does our current national elective system, does it fit with a resilient future? And the answer is maybe not.
Mark Carney might not have got it if it hadn't been for Trump.
I don't know.
Well, he knew what to do to some extent.
Mark Carney, he's not the whole deal either, though.
He wouldn't even done what he's done probably if
he's still running the existing system, which is extracting oil, sending it out through BC to China. You know, he's still part of the system. And that's what I'm saying about the Greens. I'm not sure that our current parliamentary system will actually serve us. And I don't – usually when you have a paradigm change, almost nobody makes it through as a politician. So very few are seen on the other side.
Right. So, I'm not a politician.
No. Yeah. But that's, most people are of an era, and when the era changes, most of them do too.
What we're doing on the radio, is it any use?
I have no idea, but it's interesting to have a chat with somebody and have this conversation able to be distributed. I find people in my circles and your circles, we know this stuff, but people outside it, not so much. And spreading it, can't do any harm at this stage.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on board.
That's all right. It was a pleasure.
I suspect you might be correct. I hope in many ways you're partially wrong.
Yeah.
And I think you still have to keep doing what you can do.
My yardstick's really simple, Marvin. I just ask whether my grandkids will thank me in 20 years' time for what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an easy yardstick.
Okay, well, thanks a lot we'll have this conversation again. Maybe we'll have it after I don't know. I was going to say after the boats start coming back.
I may never see you again.
Okay, I'll see you. Take care.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.